Chapter 7. Retrospective pleasure. The girl's enjoyment of her evening, and the innumerable fine feelers of sensation as he had thrown out to its impressions. It gave him a curiously close sense of her presence, to think that at that moment she was living over her enjoyment as intensely as he was living over his unhappiness. His own case was irremediable, but it was easy enough to give her a few more hours of pleasure. And did she not perhaps secretly expect it of him? After all, if as he had been very anxious to join her friends she would have telegraphed them on reaching Paris, instead of writing. He wondered now that he had not been struck at the moment by so artless a device to gain more time. The fact of her having practiced it did not make him think less well of her. It merely strengthened the impulse to use his opportunity. She was starving, poor child, for a little amusement, a little personal life. Why not give her the chance of another day in Paris? If he did so, should he not be merely falling in with her own hopes? At the thought, his sympathy for her revived. She became of absorbing interest to him as an escape from himself, and an object about which his thwarted activities could cluster. He felt less drearily alone, because of her being there, on the other side of the door, and in his gratitude to her for giving him this relief he began, with indolent amusement, to plan new ways of detaining her. He dropped back into his chair, lit a cigar, and smiled a little at the image of her smiling face. He tried to imagine what incident of the day she was likely to be recalling at that particular moment, and what party probably played in it. That it was not a small party was certain, and the knowledge was undeniably pleasant. Now and then a sound from her room brought before him more vividly the reality of the situation, and the strangeness of the vast swarming solitude in which he and she were momentarily isolated, amid long lines of rooms each holding its separate secret. The nearness of all these other mysteries enclosing theirs gave Darrow a more intimate sense of the girl's presence, and through the fumes of his cigar his imagination continued to follow her to and fro, traced the curve of her slim young arms as she raised them to undo her hair, pictured the sliding down of her dress to the waist, and then to the knees, and the whiteness of her feet as she slipped across the floor to bed. He stood up, and shook himself with a yawn, throwing away the end of his cigar. His glance, in following it, lit on the telegram which had dropped to the floor. The sounds in the next room had ceased, and once more he felt alone and unhappy. Opening the window, he folded his arms on the sill, and looked out on the vast light-spangled mass of the city, and then up at the dark sky, in which the morning planet stood. Why, at the Theatre Francaise, the next afternoon, Darrow yawned and fidgeted in his seat. The day was warm, the theater crowded and airless, and the performance, it seemed to him, intolerably bad. He stole a glance at his companion, wondering if she shared his feelings. Her rapt profile betrayed no unrest, but politeness might have caused her to feign an interest that she did not feel. He leaned back impatiently, stifling another yawn, and trying to fix his attention on the stage. Great things were going forward there, and he was not insensible to the stern beauties of the ancient drama. But the interpretation of the play seemed to him as airless and lifeless as the atmosphere of the theater. The players were the same whom he had often applauded in those very parts, and perhaps that fact added to the impression of staleness and conventionality produced by their performance. Surely it was time to infuse new blood into the veins of the moribund art. He had the impression that the ghosts of actors were giving a spectral performance on the shores of Styx. Certainly it was not the most profitable way for a young man with a pretty companion to pass the golden hours of a spring afternoon. The freshness of the face at his side, reflecting the freshness of the season, suggested dapplings of sunlight through new leaves, the sound of a brook in the grass, the ripple of tree shadows over breezy meadows. When at length the fateful march of the Cawthorns was stayed by the single pause in the play, and Darrow had led Miss Viner out on the balcony overhanging the square before the theater, he turned to see if she shared his feelings. But the rapturous look she gave him checked the depreciation on his lips. Oh, why did you bring me out here? One ought to creep away and sit in the dark till it begins again. Is that the way they made you feel? Didn't they you, as if the gods were there all the while, just behind them, pulling the strings? Her hands were pressed against the railing, her face shining and darkening under the wingbeats of successive impressions. Darrow smiled in enjoyment of her pleasure. After all, he had felt all that, long ago. Perhaps it was his own fault, rather than that of the actors, that the poetry of the play seemed to have evaporated. But no, he had been right in judging the performance to be dull and stale. It was simply his companion's inexperience, her lack of occasions to compare and estimate, that made her think it brilliant. I was afraid you were bored and wanted to come away. Bored? She made a little aggrieved grimace. You mean you thought me too ignorant and stupid to appreciate it? No, not that. The hand nearest him still lay on the railing of the balcony, and he covered it for a moment with his. As he did, so he saw the color rise and tremble in her cheek. Tell me just what you think, he said, bending his head a little, and only half aware of his words. She did not turn her face to his, but began to talk rapidly, trying to convey something of what she felt. But she was evidently unused to analyzing her aesthetic emotions, and the tumultuous rush of the drama seemed to have left her in a state of panting wonder, as though it had been a storm or some other natural cataclysm. As he had no literary or historic associations to which to attach her impressions. Her education had evidently not comprised a course in Greek literature. But she felt what would probably have been unperceived by many a young lady who had taken a first in classics. The ineluctable fatality of the tale, the dread sway in it of the same mysterious hook which pulled the threads of her own small destiny. It was not literature to her, it was fact. As actual, as nearby, as what was happening to her at the moment, and what the next hour held in store. Seen in this light, the play regained for Darrow its supreme and poignant reality. He pierced to the heart of its significance through all the artificial accretions with which his theories of art and the conventions of the stage had clothed it, and saw it as he had never seen it. As life. After this there could be no question of flight, and he took her back to the theater, content to receive his own sensations through the medium of hers. But with the continuation of the play, and the oppression of the heavy air, his attention again began to wander, straying back over the incidents of the morning. He had been with Sophie Viner all day, and he was surprised to find how quickly the time had gone. As he had hardly attempted, as the hours passed, to conceal her satisfaction on finding that no telegram came from the Farlows. Hale have written, as he had simply said, and her mind had at once flown onto the golden prospect of an afternoon at the theater. The intervening hours had been disposed of in a stroll through the lively streets, and a repast, luxuriously lingered over, under the chestnut boughs of a restaurant in the Champs-Élysées. Everything entertained and interested her, and Darrow remarked, with an amused detachment, that she was not insensible to the impression her charms produced. Yet there was no hard edge of vanity in her sense of her prettiness. She seemed simply to be aware of it as a note in the general harmony, and to enjoy sounding the note as a singer enjoys singing. After luncheon, as they sat over their coffee, as he had again asked an immense number of questions, and delivered herself of a remarkable variety of opinions. Her questions testified to a wholesome and comprehensive human curiosity, and her comments showed, like her face and her whole attitude, an odd mingling of precocious wisdom and disarming ignorance. When she talked to him about life, the word was often on her lips. She seemed to him like a child playing with a tiger's cub. And he said to himself that someday the child would grow up, and so would the tiger. Meanwhile, such expertness qualified by such candor made it impossible to guess the extent of her personal experience, or to estimate its effect on her character. She might be any one of a dozen definable types, or she might more disconcertingly to her companion, and more perilously to herself be a shifting and uncrystallized mixture of them all. Her talk, as usual, had promptly reverted to the stage. She was eager to learn about every form of dramatic expression which the metropolis of things theatrical had to offer, and her curiosity ranged from the official temples of the art to its less hallowed haunts. Her searching inquiries about a play whose production, on one of the latter scenes, had provoked a considerable amount of scandal, led Darrow to throw out laughingly, colon to see that you'll have to wait till you're married. And his answer had sent her off at a tangent. Oh, I never mean to marry, as he had rejoined in a tone of youthful finality. I seem to have heard that before. Yes, from girls who have only got to choose. Her eyes had grown suddenly almost old. Do you like you to see the only men who have ever wanted to marry me? One was the doctor on the steamer when I came abroad with the hoax. He'd been cashiered from the Navy for drunkenness. The other was a deaf widower with three grown-up daughters, who kept a clock shop in Bayswater. Besides, she rambled on, I'm not so sure that I believe in marriage. You see, I'm all for self-development and the chance to live one's life. I'm awfully modern, you know. It was just when she proclaimed herself most awfully modern that she struck him as most helplessly backward. Yet the moment after, without any bravado or apparent desire to assume an attitude, she would propound some social axiom which could have been gathered only in the bitter soil of experience. All these things came back to him as he sat beside her in the theater and watched her ingenuous absorption. It was on the story that her mind was fixed, and in life also, he suspected, it would always be his story, rather than its remoter imaginative issues, that would hold her. He did not believe there were ever any echoes in her soul. There was no question, however, that what she felt was felt with intensity. To the actual, the immediate, she spread vibrating strings. When the play was over, and they came out once more into the sunlight, Darrow looked down at her with a smile. Well, he asked. She made no answer. Her dark gaze seemed to rest on him without seeing him. Her cheeks and lips were pale, and the loose hair under her hat brim clung to her forehead in damp rings. She looked like a young priestess still dazed by the fumes of the cavern. You poor child, it's been almost too much for you. She shook her head with a vague smile. Come, he went on, putting his hand on her arm, let's jump into a taxi and get some air and sunshine. Look, there are hours of daylight left, and see what a night it's going to be. He pointed over their heads, to where a white moon hung in the misty blue above the roofs of the Rue de Rivoli. She made no answer, and he signed to a motor cab, calling out to the driver, colon to the boys. As the carriage turned toward the Tuileries, she roused herself. Must go first to the hotel. There may be a message, at any rate I must decide on something. Darrow saw that the reality of the situation had suddenly forced itself upon her. Must decide on something, she repeated. He would have liked to postpone the return, to persuade her to drive directly to the boys for dinner. It would have been easy enough to remind her that she could not start for Joigny that evening, and that therefore it was of no moment whether she received the Farlow's answer then, or a few hours later, but for some reason he hesitated to use this argument, which had come so naturally to him the day before. After all, he knew she would find nothing at the hotel, so what did it matter if they went there? The porter, interrogated, was not sure. He himself had received nothing for the lady, but in his absence his subordinate might have sent a letter upstairs. Darrow and Sophie mounted together in the lift, and the young man, while she went into her room, unlocked his own door and glanced at the empty table. For him at least, no message had come, and on her threshold. A moment later, she met him with the expected colon, "No, there's nothing." He feigned an unregretful surprise. "Oh, much the better. And now, shall we drive out somewhere? Or would you rather take a boat to Bellevue? Have you ever dined there, on the terrace, by moonlight? It's not at all bad. And there's no earthly use in sitting here waiting." She stood before him in perplexity. "But when I wrote yesterday, I asked them to telegraph. I suppose they're horribly hard up, the poor dears, and they thought a letter would do as well as a telegram. The color. Gutenberg edition." End of chapter.